You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, December 9th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
All right, so got a good show coming up today, and we're going to be talking about some COVID anti-vaccine nonsense a little bit later. So just going to do a quick sort of opening banter COVID update, but I did find a couple of news items today that are both interesting and almost completely contradictory to each other. But so the question, now the vaccines are rolling out, right? Question is who gets them first? And pretty much there seems to be pretty much agreement that frontline healthcare workers should be, getting them first, like the most vulnerable people and the people who directly take care of COVID patients. So there was two studies I saw, both coming out today, looking at, well, what is the actual risk of frontline healthcare workers? So there's one study, which is UK-based, which was published in the Journal of Occupational and Environmental Medicine, which found that healthcare workers are 7 times more likely to have severe COVID-19 as other frontline workers, as other quote-unquote essential workers.
What does that mean specifically?
So if you are a healthcare worker, you're 7 times more likely to get severe COVID than if you're not, basically. Even if you're an essential or a non-essential worker, but not a healthcare worker. Then I also saw a study that showed that healthcare workers, this is a US-based study, were not more likely to get COVID from their hospital care unless they are in long-term contact with COVID patients. So what they found is that they looked at healthcare workers. They found that like nurses overall had an increased risk of getting COVID, but it was entirely from their non-healthcare contact. Mm-hmm. So we were talking about, this is funny because we were talking last week, like I feel more at risk in the store than I do at work because there's so much PPE and everyone's doing what they're supposed to be doing. And this study kind of bears that out. Like nurses who get COVID are more likely to get them from the community than from the hospital.
Wow.
But the one exception to that are nurses who are in prolonged contact with COVID positive patients. And so that's primarily nurses who are managing hemodialysis and who are handling respiratory care. So, yeah, it's interesting. We're giving like high flow oxygen therapy.
How long are those treatments, Steve? In other words, how many hours a time are we talking for these people?
Well, like hemodialysis takes several hours, right? And then if you're managing, it says high flow oxygen therapy, that could take a long time as well.
Huh.
So what that shows that PPE, when you know, high-level PPE, the kind that is being used in hospitals and used consistently, basically works.
Mm-hmm.
But that prolonged exposure is still probably going to get around it. But those are the people who should be using the N95, you know, masks,
right?
And like eye protection and full gowns and gloves, you know, things like that. Like they really need to take all those extra steps, not like just wearing a face mask. You have to be doing everything. There's also a study which showed, by the way, that you know how some people wear those face shields, like the clear plastic face shields?
Oh, yeah. I read this,
Yeah, they do not work as well as masks. So they're not a substitute for wearing a mask. It's okay to use them, but you need to have a mask too.
I don't think I've ever seen somebody wear it instead of a mask.
Yeah.
That's not good.
I've seen.
I mean, they're common in our hospital, but you know, people obviously are wearing masks underneath them.
Oh, yeah. In the hospital, I've only seen it in addition to masks. But I guess maybe some people outside the context of a hospital think, oh, I could just wear the see-through face mask.
But there's like just a giant gap underneath your mouth.
I know,
right?
I know.
So what is the face shield actually doing,
it's protecting you spit from getting on the rest of your face.
Yeah, it's good for spit. It's not good for sneezes because I was just recently reading about it, like the vortices that are created when you sneeze.
Yeah.
Can actually go above and below and inside the mask. So they're trying. I think some Japanese company was trying to redesign masks to ameliorate that. But yeah, you got to use. Yeah, the goal is to have a mask that's just as good, a face shield that's just as good as a mask. So you don't need the mask, which would be a boon for these frontline people because they wouldn't have to wear a mask on their face all day. But we're not there yet.
Yeah, that's like a biohazard suit.
So it's a sneeze shield, really, like a sneeze guard at a salad bar.
Yeah, that's basically, it's just impenetrable, but it has a giant gap at the bottom. Bob, how well does it work for your germ cloud?
But there are
workers at the hospital who, like, if you're a respiratory therapist who's going around seeing patient to patient, they're in full gear. Like, they have rebreathers on. They have, like, gas masks on.
Steve, like, they're wearing something that's giving them oxygen?
No. They have a filter. Like, they have a, you know what I mean?
Like, oh, a heavy duty, like an army filter, right?
Yeah. So they have, like, a full face mask on and they're breathing through a filter.
Okay.
With no gaps. Like, it's closed everywhere. Yeah. Yes. That's like, the point. It, like, fits really tightly and it's been tested.
Nothing's getting in that hasn't been filtered.
Yes. Correct.
And that filter, I'm sure, is what? Like, equivalent to an N95? Do they go even better than that if it's more industrial?
Well, there's N99s. Yeah. So
I want
rated
one of those.
Also, remember, N95 just refers to the percentage.
Yeah, 95%.
Like the efficacy. It doesn't refer to the actual size of the filtration. There are different versions of N95 masks.
Yeah, we're generally talking, when we say you have to wear an N95 mask, we're talking about filtering out 95% of viral size.
Viral grade. Yeah, right. Exactly.
Right.
There are N95s for larger things like bacteria. Mm. There are N95s. For smaller viruses, like they come in different, you know, there are different kinds of N95s.
Yeah. So we're in the U.S., 288,000 people have died so far from COVID. We're over 15 million cases.
Steve, I don't think you noticed the most recent update. Today we hit over 3,000. It was our first time.
288,000 total.
Oh, okay.
You're talking about per day we broke 3,000.
Yeah, we broke 3,000 for the first time just today.
We're regularly breaking 200,000 new cases per day. This surge is dwarfing the previous two, and they're saying we really haven't peaked yet because, you know, and we're still probably going to see some post-Thanksgiving peak.
Yeah.
And we're heading into Christmas, so and of course we're heading into, you know, into winter where people are going to be staying inside more.
All bad signs.
Yeah, it's all bad. But the good thing is the vaccine's coming out, and the question is going to be like, how quickly can we get that out?
Right.
And of course the whole world is dealing with this problem right now. But you know, the Chinese came out with their vaccine. They say is 85% effective.
But the Russian one, I guess that's still going out there.
Yeah, I just can't believe anything they're saying though. Unfortunately, but
yeah,
but they do have a vaccine. And there's 15 other ones in the pipeline, you know. Again, that's, you know, clearly we can't manage this without the vaccine. You know, just having people do what they're supposed to do is not working.
It's too much to ask, apparently.
There's too much misinformation, too much politicization in the U.S. at least. You know what I mean? It's just crazy.
It's ridiculous.
It does seem to be worse here for sure, but you see the same kind of crank stuff in a lot of Western nations as well, and some Eastern.
But smaller scale is my
worse here. I think a lot of it is actually kind of like imported from America.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone's politicized it the way we have.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, probably not going to end. It's going to put that they're just going to, you know, again, they're already gearing up to resist the vaccine in some quarters, and Carrie, you'll be talking about that. But first, we're going to go on to the news items, and we're going to start with some what I always consider to be bittersweet news. When somebody lives to a ripe old age, but then they do eventually die. Actually, my wife's great uncle just passed away. He was exactly 100 years old.
That's great.
Yeah, it's great. And he was pretty much in good health up until the very end, like birth minute,
or what do you mean exactly?
Come on,
what do you mean? No, he, yeah, like
picosecond. Year, exactly,
I mean, he's 100 years
silly.
Old. But like, that's, I mean, who wouldn't buy that? I'll buy that right now. 100.
Yeah, sign up for 100.
Yeah, I'll really sign up for 100. And in good health until 100.
In good
I'll
health
take it.
Until he was 100 years old. Really,
that's epic.
Then,
pretty much a rapid
check,
decline, could, and then passing away.
I feel like it's almost hard to be. I mean, obviously, there's the grief and the loss of losing somebody that you love. But there's a phenomenon like when you lose somebody who has had dementia for a long time, where the grief processing starts before their death.
Yeah.
And so I can imagine that somebody who is so long lived that it's almost like, this is amazing that they made it this far. That probably overshadows like the sadness of the loss simply because, you know, their life was so lived.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it overshadows it, but it does mitigate it a lot. But anyway, we're talking about Chuck Yeager, who died this week. Jay, you're going to tell us about Chuck.
Yeah, Chuck Yeager had a very very busy life, and you accomplish a lot of things that most people probably don't know about. So I'll give you a quick overview on Chuck Yeager. I always looked up to this man for lots of different reasons. He was born on February 13th in 1923. He was best known for being the first person to break the sound barrier, which means you're going the speed of sound or faster than the speed of sound. So before that famous moment, he started off, of course, as a young man from West Virginia with only a high school education. He lived in a small town of about 400 people. And right when World War II started, he enlisted as soon as he got out of high school. He got into the Air Force. This was in 1941. He started his military career as an airplane mechanic. And not too long after that, on his first flight in an actual airplane, he got sick and threw up on the airplane, which I thought was really, really humbling, right? In 1942, he joined the flight program for enlisted men and finally received his pilot wings in 1943 out of a base in Arizona. So he always had a cool head. He was a very quick learner. He actually enjoyed the extremes of flying. He really liked to do dives and spins in the airplane. He was showing the ability to handle that type of stuff right from the beginning. And in World War II, Yeager was a fighter pilot, and he impressively shot down 5 enemy planes in one day. And he got his
wow,
his ace.
Ace, yeah.
I think that's really a hard thing to do. So his P-51 Mustang was shot down on March 1944 over France by a German fighter pilot, and his leg and head were injured when he hit the ground. He was luckily found and cared for by the French resistance, and he actually had to hike from France to Spain to eventually get back to his base in England.
Wow.
And when he got back, they were basically giving him the, yep, you crashed, and it's take it easy time. They were going to remove him from combat, and he insisted to go back into combat, which he did. And it's characteristics like that that I find to be extraordinarily impressive. So after the war, he was assigned to an army base in California where he was one of the top pilots, and they were testing prototype jets. And it was at this time that he was chosen to fly the plane that broke the sound barrier. He was actually selected over more seasoned pilots. And you have to, think they picked him because they saw the characteristics of someone that could handle that kind of stress and that kind of situation. This was like very untested and dangerous,
expendable
thing to do. They a lot of engineers were convinced that an airplane could not handle the shockwave of going faster than the speed of sound. But they managed to pull it off on October 14th, 1947, and the plane was called the Bell Aircraft X-1, and it was attached to a B-29 bomber. It was released at 23,000 feet. The plane shot up to 43,000 feet over the Mojave Desert. He hit 700 miles per hour. He broke the sound barrier. And, his comment about doing it was that there wasn't an obvious moment when the plane achieved the speed of sound. I think he was expecting there to be some type of event, like a sound or a rumble or something.
There was. It was just behind him, so we didn't hear it.
Yeah, I know, right?
He was out in front of it.
But what a moment in aviation history, right? It lines right up with the first people, the Wright brothers. It's one of those seminal moments. In 1949, his base that he was stationed at was renamed the Edwards Air Force Base, and it actually became the center for all of the advanced aviation research, which was right there, the very beginnings of the space program. And he broke another speed record in 1953, flying the X-1A plane that he got to about 2.5 times the speed of sound,
wow.
And he almost got killed in that flight. That flight almost killed him, and he got into a very, very hard-to-recover-from tailspin.
But he
pulled it off.
Heard about that.
And in 62, he became the commander of the astronaut training school at Edwards Air Force Base. Then he went into the Vietnam War, and he commanded a fighter wing and flew 127 missions. After the war, he went on to head aerospace safety for the Air Force, and he retired in 1975.
He was a brigadier general when he retired.
That's right. Now, a couple of interesting things. First, I found out that when he broke the speed of sound, they kept it under wraps for a year. They didn't want to reveal that it happened because it was a highly important military secret. Yeah, but it did come out a year later, and he didn't really, really become popular or incredibly famous until the book and then the subsequent movie, The Right Stuff, came out. The book came out in 79. The movie followed, you know, 2 to 3 years after that. And because of his fame, people would commonly ask him, you know, hey, were you born with the right stuff? Which was basically, you know, he heard it as them saying, you know, were you born with all of these skills? And Yeager wrote in his memoir, you know, the answer is no. It was the result of extremely hard work. And it was his experience flying planes that got him there. It was, you know, the 10,000 legitimately he put in over 10,000 hours flying airplanes. And he said it also was to the fact that he, you know, luck or whatever skill and luck, that he didn't die. He survived all the danger. And he said, I was always afraid of dying, always, which is good. You know, you don't do things like that. You don't risk your life like that. If you're not afraid of dying, you're going to be take too many risks. And he was the kind of guy that he would learn the plane inside and out. He knew every, you know, he knew mm-hmm. all the details about the engineering of the plane, but he also knew like all of the safety mechanisms and everything. Like, he got involved in those details, and it probably is one of the reasons that kept him alive. Mm-hmm. He died at 97 years old. So, you know, that is, mm-hmm. That
for
is
a test pilot. That's really good.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. Fantastic life. Uh-huh. Yeah. Incredible achievement. You know, just a straight shooter type of guy, you know, and I just find that to be, I don't know, in today's world, I know that we have people like that. You know, they're just not glorified, I think, the way that I would like them to be, because we need heroes in our world, you know, and he mm-hmm. most certainly was, you know, an achievement hero. He did very difficult, incredible things. And yeah. he ended up being an incredible human being. And I really, God, I love that scene in The Right Stuff when his plane crashes and he's kind of got black all over him and he's limping and he walks away from the plane. And he just has, the actor did such an amazing yeah. job. Like that look on his Sam face, Shepherd. Just so stone cold, you know, like I did it. Let's move on. You know what I mean?
All right. I have to tell my Chuck Yeager anecdote.
Yes, I love it. You told me oh. already, and I love it.
So okay. I saw him in the flesh once. It was in 1989 during – I was living in D.C. at the time, and that was the inauguration for George H.W. Bush. We're like, what the hell? You know, might be the only time we're in D.C. during a presidential inauguration. So we went. You know, we were just in the crowd, but the there was like a parade, and we were pretty close to one of the, you know, the path that the parade was taking. And at one point, a car goes by, and in the car is Bob Hope and Chuck Yeager. You know, Bob Hope, you know, in addition to just being a movie star, did a lot of work for the USO. You know, so that was kind of his affiliation yeah. with the yeah. military. And so the crowd was going crazy for Bob Hope. And they're like, we love you, Bob, blah, blah, blah. And the group of people I was with is like, do they know who Bob Hope is sitting next to? Because that guy should be more famous than Bob
right.
Hope.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And so I don't even know if they recognized him. We did, of course, because, you know, by that point, you know, Chuck Yeager was a hero for us. So we started shouting out, we love you, Chuck. And he turned to us and waved. It was cool.
Say it, awesome. He looked me in the eyes.
That's hilarious.
It was, yeah. It was
he jumped out of the car, ran over to you, gave you a big hug.
Yeah, that's how I remember it now, right? No, it was good. It was a fun moment.
It makes sense. You know, we get it. You know, you see the movie stars and TV mm-hmm. personalities so much more. You have more of a relationship with those people.
Well, also you recognize their faces.
Yeah.
Like you, mm-hmm. like Chuck Yeager for a lot of people is a concept.
Yeah.
Not a person.
Although at the time he was famous with battery commercials.
Oh, I had no idea.
So most people should have recognized him.
Yeah, but yeah, what if they're like, oh, it's the guy from the battery commercial.
But also,
it's Robert Conrad.
Oh, boy. Chuck Yeager didn't, you know, he doesn't have an actor's charisma. You know what I yeah. mean? Like you're looking at Bob Hope had intense right. charisma. That guy was so charismatic. And of course, we're going to remember those people and recognize them and have emotions connected to them. I just find it to be something. He's someone to highly respect because he yes. did all of these things. I mean, if it weren't for him, a lot of things wouldn't be the way that they are today. You know, like he tested things that other people probably would have tested, but would they have done it? Would it have succeeded? He had a ton of input into all of this stuff. He started, he was one of the people that started the United States getting into outer space, which, you know, to me is just one of the most important things of my childhood is everything to do with outer space. So whatever. I mean, he was an incredible human being, and I give him mad respect. And, God, 97 years old.
Yeah, I am so happy he lived to 97. Yeah. Good for him.
Yeah.
All right, Bob, tell us about this is now you talk about technological breakthroughs, right? Tell us about the Smellicopter.
Smellicopter.
What is
this thing? What?
Smellicopter.
No, that's like from
this is a thing,
Simpsons or something.
Right? This is a thing in 2020, Smellicopter. So researchers have created a drone with a live moth antenna attached to find specific odors autonomously in dangerous areas with better efficiency than any artificial sensor we can currently create. So this is both cool and pretty damn creepy, which means, of course, I was drawn to it like a fly to a corpse. This was published recently in the journal IOP, Bioinspiration and Biomimetics. So moths and butterflies of the order Lepidoptera, which I love. I've always loved that name ever since I first heard or read Stephen Jay Gould. Or whoever the narrator was to his audiobook, say that word.
I'm partial to Hymenoptera myself.
Lepidoptera don't have noses, but they do have antennae for smelling and balance probably as well. And they are really good at smelling, but especially moths with their often far more ornate, they've got these feathered antennae, which have chitin hairs or sensilla on them, each with their own scent receptors. They're amazing tools. Now they work by greatly enhancing chemical signals. Basically, they're like PCR amplifying DNA. A moth antenna can take one single scent molecule and amplify it so it can be identified. No human made sensor is that sensitive yet. Anyway, of course we'll get there. So some male moths can sense a female's hormones from 11 kilometers, which is 7 miles away. 7 kilometers away. Or 11 kilometers. So the smelling ability has been usurped, if you will, by scientists by putting a moth antenna on a drone. Yes, a drone. And they call it, of course, a smellicopter. And how could they call it anything else? So how do they even
do that?
You
could call it Mothra.
Mothra, that'd be decent, but smellicopter just takes it. It's so obvious. So how does one even do that? How do you go about attaching putting those two things that have never been attached together? So you put the poor moth, first of all, and in this case, the moth is a Manduca sexta hawk moth, which is an awesome name. I put that in a refrigerator to numb it, apparently, and then they remove one antenna, which will grow back, I believe. Now, such an antenna can stay actually biologically and chemically active for up to 4 hours, or even longer if you store it properly. So that's 4 hours. You could do a lot of searching. So the researchers basically just add wires into one of the ends of the antenna. It's essentially like a tube filled with chemicals in a sense. So you connect one end in the antenna and you create an electrical circuit. And they just need then to measure the average signal from all the cells in the antenna. And bam, you have an olfactory sensor. It seems, I'm sure it's a little complicated, but they made it sound kind of easy. To do that. So they tested it, right? You put this together, you make it into a circuit and you could use it. So then you got to test it. So they tested it against a modern artificial sensor. They basically put both of them at the end of a wind tunnel and they would waft some scents through the wind tunnel. And the Frankenstein antenna reacted faster and took less time to reset and be ready for the next smell than the one that we had created. So this was definitely superior, more efficient. Smaller, lightweight, low power. I mean, the thing had it all. They then, of course, attached it to a drone, and someone said, it's a smellicopter. So I'm just going with this Frankenstein theme, of course. So this was a commercial handheld regular quadricopter, nothing really that special, but it did allow for special features to be added, and they included two plastic fins on the back, which creates drag, right? Imagine this thing is in the air. You got these two little fins in the back, and it creates drag, which then makes sure the drone is always pointing upwind. And this that was actually an interesting advance, apparently, regarding the fins. Co-author and co-advisor Sawyer Fuller, UW assistant professor of mechanical engineering, he said, from a robotics perspective, this is genius. The classic approach in robotics, of course, is to add more sensors, maybe build a fancy algorithm or use machine learning to estimate wind direction. It turns out all you need is to add a fin. So that's a funny little aside. Just throw these fins on and just keep it simple, stupid. And that wasn't common knowledge that's all you have to do to make it head into the wind. Okay, so the smellicopter that they made is surprisingly autonomous. This wasn't meant to have a guy with VR goggles flying it like a drone in Afghanistan. As it flies by itself, and it sweeps back and forth looking for specific chemical signatures. And when it finds it, it surges towards it. But it also needs to make sure that it's not bumping into things. So it's got five IR sensors, infrared sensors, that pulse like every like 10th of a second. And they have them to detect any potential obstacles. And that works very well. And it also doesn't even need GPS. It just uses a camera to see its environment, which is great, of course, if you're just exploring like indoors or underground areas. That's a great way to get around. So it's very, you know, surprisingly autonomous. So if it isn't obvious, then what would we use a smellicopter for? My first thought was that perhaps you could rent it out to moths who don't have antennas that are searching for a mate and want to find one. But there's other possible uses. According to Thomas Daniel, UW professor, he said that the ability to detect and localize odors has a vast range of potential applications. Essentially, anywhere we might use dogs for tracking or sensing odors is a potential application for the smellicopter. It has the unique advantage that it flies and can navigate in complex environments. Moreover, it avoids putting dogs or humans in harm's way. Everything from detecting gas leaks to disease outbreaks in crops to the volatiles emitted from improvised explosive devices and potential areas are potential areas of application. So lots of possibilities with this, as long as you have that 4 or 5 hour window, I suppose. So in the future, if you look at what they tested in the lab here during their research, you know, this thing flew towards smells that moths find interesting, like floral scents and females, I suppose. In the future, they're going to need to tweak that because I don't think there's going to be too much need, you know, for these drones to find floral scents, maybe unless you're looking for specific flowers. So in the future, they're going to have to do some serious work on getting it to detect chemical signatures that are really, really important. Like, for example, exhaled carbon dioxide, right? That would be critical. Like someone's trapped under earthquake rubble. If you could detect that, then you would be golden. Or how about this? You could search for chemicals related to explosives, like unexploded bombs. That would come in handy. How hard is that going to be? Yep. I don't know, because I don't think there's any moth antennas that are suited for that. So I don't know how difficult that's actually going to be. Let's see. I'll end with another quote by Sawyer Fuller. He said, "Finding plume sources is a perfect task for little robots like the smellicopter. Larger robots are capable of carrying an array of different sensors around and using them to build a map of their world. We can't really do that at the small scale, however. But to find the source of a plume, all a robot needs to do is avoid obstacles and stay in the plume while it moves upwind. That's it. It doesn't need a sophisticated sensor suite for that. It just needs to be able to smell really well. And that's what the smellicopter is really good at. So for certain of these niche applications, the smellicopter is the best thing we have for this. You know, we've got bigger, more capable robots on the ground that could build up maps of the environment much better than anything in the air. But for just finding the source of a smell, this is a really good way to do it.
So is the smellicopter a cyborg?
Right. Now, it needs another name.
Here we go.
Like a is a taco a sandwich?
Yeah, like
an existential discussion.
How about a bio?
It's a whole thing.
It's a smellborg.
Maury Amsterdam was not a sandwich.
All right, Kara.
Yes.
So why is an anti-vaccine doctor giving testimony to the Senate?
Well, here's the thing. Oh, she already did. And the fascinating part of this story is I found some write-ups about the fact that Dr. Jane M. Orient was going to, because the write-ups were all written beforehand, testify before a Senate committee yesterday on Tuesday, December 8th. And so as I'm, you know, reading all about her testimony and how a lot of people are pissed about this, I'm thinking, well, why don't I just watch this testimony? So I pull it up and I'm able to watch it in full. And there's a tiny bit of commentary in some of the places that I've watched it. But interestingly, so far, I haven't been able to find any write-ups. I've only found people talking about it happening in the future.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be interested to see if some sort of like op-eds come out after the fact about all the garbage that she was spewing.
Yeah.
But let's break
maybe on science-based medicine.
Right. Yeah. And I looked. I did look. And actually, Gorski wrote about it on his other blog.
Mm-hmm.
So he wrote about it beforehand and gave me a lot more context, actually, which was really helpful, because I think that when the New York Times wrote it up, they did a couple of annoying things. At first, they called her an anti-vaccine scientist, which is frustrating because she's not a scientist.
Not a scientist. She knows I call her a doctor, not a scientist.
Yeah. And then they also still, even after they changed the headline to anti-vaccine doctor, they still say in the very first, like in the lead sentence, a doctor who is skeptical of coronavirus vaccines. Which is like, oh, that's such a not what the word skeptical
means. Yeah, that's not reality. Denialist. So,
yeah, that's a whole other thing, a whole other can of worms that we've dug into a lot on the show about, you know, the use of the term skeptic and skeptical and what it actually means. But I think going on too much of a tangent on that might take us away from the main point of this, which is Dr. Jane M. Orient. She's the executive director of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons.
Sounds legitimate.
It really does.
Isn't it
actually.
Says association in that title.
And we've talked about the Association of the American Physicians and Surgeons in the past on this show. If you want a super deep dive on how crank this organization is, I definitely recommend looking up the many things that David Gorski has written about it, like the many articles in Science-Based Medicine about it. But basically, this is a professional organization that has a very strong right-wing bent. It also has a very strong science denialist, conspiracy mongering bent. It calls itself a professional medical society, but their core mandate, like deep down, all of the work that they do is to promote freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Medical freedom.
You can't even really call them a professional organization. And even saying they're quote unquote right wing doesn't cover it. This is a radical, real, you know, capital L libertarian, absolute freedom. And by freedom, that's like zero regulation. They think that doctors should be able to do whatever they want without any government regulation or oversight whatsoever.
Well, that's not dangerous.
So, of course, even if like the originally, like this is founded in the 1940s. So even if you sort of came to that position because of an extreme ideology, once you have an organization dedicated to that, it's going to attract every crank doctor that exists. And over time, it just became a completely crank organization. But it's still keeping to their sort of radical roots. The first article that's active on their website right now, here's the opening line. So it's not like they even try to hide their political ideology. This is an article on an ostensibly medical professional organization's website. First paragraph says, "One is hard-pressed to deny that Joe Biden is a weak, corrupt, pathologically lying, creepy, dirty old man who has lived off the government teat for 50 years. And he allegedly won the 2020 presidential election. Are Americans that ignorant? Or has Joseph Stalin's political philosophy that has been simmering in America for years finally come to fruition? COVID was the not-so-secret agent." The whole article is about how COVID is being used as a pretext for a communist takeover of the United States. That's what we're talking about. This is an ideological organization pretending to be a professional organization. That's what this is.
Right, but unfortunately it has a full veneer and sheen in the eyes of many of a legitimate professional organization, and that's the problem. Yeah. It's very bad.
Sure.
And as you mentioned, like she didn't try to hide it during her testimony either. It wasn't that overt by any stretch of the imagination. But she would, you know, do all the classic logical fallacies where she was constantly moving the goalpost. She was constantly setting up straw men just to knock them down. And she did. I remember at one point during her testimony, she did the classic like, well, what we believe in my organization is that treatment is between a doctor and a patient, not between a patient and their government, not between a doctor and a regulatory body, and that no government has any right to infringe on our rights to do what's best for our patients. So that's kind of how she's constantly couching this and conceptualizing this.
That last statement is critical. Well, yeah, who determines what's best for your patient? Clearly, you can't do that.
And so they view, you know, federal vaccine mandates as a direct violation of human rights. And let's be clear again, Dr. Orient is the executive director, and this was not a recent appointment. I think she's been the executive director since like 1979. So she is a woman who has a lot of influence in the mandates and the policies of this crank organization. There is a fair amount of evidence to show that this, as I love this, as David Gorski put it, John Birch Society-like group that's masquerading as a medical society. Here's some great claims that they've made throughout the years. That shaken baby syndrome is a misdiagnosis for vaccine injury. That the measles vaccine will result in a mass extinction of humans.
Measles.
Remember when that happened?
Still, oh, well, it hasn't happened yet.
That climate science does not exist, that HIV/AIDS does not exist, that breast cancer is caused by abortion.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Are you reading from Goop or are you reading from
the website? No, I know, right? It's amazing.
By the way, the one time they want the government to get between a doctor and his patient is when it comes to reproductive rights. That's
of course. Yeah, we got to ban that outright.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah. And one thing that's that David Gorski pointed out, which I think is also really, really important, is that there's an argument that's often made by this organization that the sort of kind of medical freedom argument that they try to utilize actually goes to the root of scientific consensus as a whole. They reject evidence-based medicine.
Totally.
Not just that they're rejecting all of these they're promoting all of these pseudoscience concepts, but they're actually rejecting the concept of scientific consensus. So they have the alternative view. They are, you know, their autonomy is more important than the consensus of experts. You may remember that when Trump first made his first pick many moons ago, after many fire, if we go back before all the firings, Trump's first pick to be his Secretary of Health and Human Services, Tom Price, was a member of this organization. So that was a massive red flag. And also, they have, you know, sued to protect their rights to pander to the anti-vax crowd in the past. Specifically, Jane Orient has spoken about Hillary Clinton having had Parkinson's disease. She's peddled that conspiracy theory. She's talked about anti-vaxxer conspiracies around Zika or anti-vax conspiracies. When it comes to COVID-19, this is sort of the drum that she's beating. Masks don't work to slow the spread of the disease, but what we should all be doing is taking hydroxychloroquine. But as I was scrubbing through looking at her specific responses, they seem to fit in with the hearing. And so I started thinking, like, what is this entire Senate hearing? And I pulled up, you guys can actually go online right now and you can find this. It's called Early Outpatient Treatment, an Essential Part of a COVID-19 Solution, Part 2. And you can go through and you can read all of the testimony of the multiple people who spoke, all of whom are either MDs or MD-PhDs, all of whom, I guess, are talking about early outpatient treatment. A lot of them are describing the drug, what is it, ivermectin?
Yeah.
Yeah, but a fair amount of them are actually talking about hydroxychloroquine. So, it's funny because the news that I was reading leading up to this was like, what an embarrassment. How could they invite Jane Orient? And yes, it's because her only affiliation is the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, as opposed to these other individuals who are testifying from Stanford, from a pharmaceutical company, from St. Luke's Aurora Medical Center.
You mean real scientists?
Some, or real doctors. But what I'm finding is actually, the deeper that I dig into this, is actually a shruggy problem more than anything. So you have, with these COVID-19 vaccine conspiracies, I think the reason that they've been able to take such extreme root is that you have the overt peddling cranks like the Dr. Jane Orients of the world, and then you have the legitimate scientists and physicians who are almost so naive that they don't realize that there is an active disinformation campaign going on. So they don't do their homework before somebody comes to testify. They don't understand the importance of persuasive language when they talk about these things. And then they seem surprised when certain Senate hearings, for example, come across as farcical. And that's the part that I'm struggling with so much, is the normalization or the both-sidesiness of the anti-vax movement. It's become so mainstream over the course of, really honestly since Wakefield, but especially more recently over the course of existing under an anti-science administration. Mm-hmm. And it's become difficult because it's got its tentacles deeply into our government.
Of course.
Very, very deeply.
I mean, the second that the government lets its guard down, you know, they're going to come pushing in. They're spilling in as far as they can get. I mean, in, you know, this administration, the past 4 years, is a perfect lesson for the entire world to learn about how dangerous it is to not hold the brightly burning torch of legitimate science, mm-hmm, as the absolute gate, that it has to be legitimate.
And I think very often, even, you know, respected scientists, respected, you know, evidence-based policymakers, respected physicians who care immensely about public health are hoodwinked by conspiracy theories because they sort of miss that central objective that's out there. They're constantly surprised by, you know, a supposed expert's view when they finally let it slip, or when, you know, the evidence becomes more obvious that this person is anti-vax. Because the thing about skillful anti-vaxxers is that they use, you know, doublespeak. Mm-hmm. They're very good at sounding legitimate. Really, any skillful pseudoscientist is good at that.
Sure.
And so, you know, they cherry pick evidence. They often set up, you know, impossible expectations of what science can actually deliver. So they will, you know, you'll see these articles coming out recently about the new Pfizer and BioNTech vaccine, saying like, well, we don't know about its reproductive outcomes. We don't know how it's going to affect people 10 years down the line. It's like, no, we don't. There's no way to know that. That is not what we studied in this. But what we do know is that it's 95% effective. And according to a thorough and rigorous drug trial and multiple review boards at this point, not just the American FDA looking through this drug, but the Canadian equivalent of that, multiple European equivalents of that, are saying this is safe. We've looked at the data and we're saying that right now it is safe and effective. And as a public health measure, the risks do not outweigh the benefits.
Right. And also, while this is true that these are the first mRNA vaccines, like, the company Moderna has been working on mRNA technology for 10 years.
For sure.
This is not a new technology. And there's lots of data in animals. And mm-hmm, yes, they're not people, but at a fundamental biological level, we don't expect it to do something different in people cells versus other mammal cells. You know, so it's not like there's going to be something that surprising in store in terms of the basic technology.
Right. So, but what these anti-vaxxers love to do is like set up these, what's the logical fallacy where it's like the, but what about with something that has no evidence to support it? So she recently wrote a blog post, Dr. Jane Orient, called Should We Line Up for a 90% Effective Vaccine? And in it, she specifically wrote, and this is cited in the New York Times article, because the effect on fertility has not been, she's saying that, you know, young people should be really cautious about getting vaccinated, quote, because the effect on fertility has not been determined. And it's like, yeah, but there's also no evidence that there that there's any risk of infertility. You're literally just making up something that could happen, that there's no evidence to say it happened, and say, because we didn't study this conclusively or
it's like,
you know,
the negative of special pleading. You know, you're just making up things that there's no particular reason to worry about this and there's no mm-hmm evidence for it. But sure, there's 1,000 things we haven't proven about pretty much any treatment.
Exactly.
You know? It's all risk versus benefit, and risk is never zero. But at some point, we could say, all right, you know, tens of thousands of people have gotten this for months. And that's usually the time frame where side effects start to appear in vaccines. So we could make probabilistic statements about the safety, like every other medical intervention. And it's sort of, well, it's like orders of magnitude safer than the risks of getting COVID, you know. So COVID is, we kind of have pretty good data now on what kind of a risk that is. And that's just considering the individual risk. It's not even considering the secondary benefit of stopping the pandemic. You know,
and that's one of the things that I'm finding
to other people.
to be the most frustrating about the arguments that I'm seeing from anti-vaxxers who deny mitigation efforts, right? Deny that masks work, deny that we should be in lockdown because of pure political, ideological reasons.
Yeah. Only their snake oil works.
That's but then they say, you know, do X, Y, and Z where there's no evidence to support that. So it's like, what do you actually want? I mean, we know what they actually want, to peddle their snake oil, but it's really frustrating to see people who are anti-lockdown then being anti-vaccine. You can't have it both ways. And this, they're as we know, is the biggest and most effective chance we have for you know, for a global public health strategy, because as we were just talking about, you know, at the beginning of the episode, unfortunately, we know how to prevent the spread of this, but people aren't willing to take those steps.
It's not only that. I mean, yeah, it's not only that not enough people are willing to be good about it. It's like there are significant downsides. Like, you could only shut down so much, so often, so thoroughly. That's a huge sacrifice that we're making in order to do that. And so to consider it's you have to consider the risk versus benefit of everything you do, everything you don't do, and every alternative. And the vaccine is absolutely the best pathway.
It's why we've
to
been
get
working
out of this pandemic
so hard at it from the beginning.
Yeah. All right, let's shift gears a little bit. Evan, you're going to tell us about this Israeli general who says we've contacted aliens. Where have I heard this?
Cool. Oh, gosh. This story's been everywhere.
Yeah.
Not just contacted. Oh, it's even deeper than that, Steve. We read about this first, I think, in the Jerusalem Post, where they reported a few days ago that a retired Israeli general claims the existence of a galactic federation, which has supposedly been in contact with Israel and the United States for years. And the general claims that the reason no one, well, until now, has known about this is to prevent hysteria, because humanity is not ready to deal with this reality.
Well, because, Evan, I was just about to become hysterical.
Exactly. Jay, you were about to, you know, flail your arms like Kermit the Frog, you know, and run around run around the room screaming. Boy, I love good old-fashioned extraordinary claims, don't you? Yes, this is the meat and potatoes of the skeptical movement, for lots of reasons, not the least of which is the examination of the evidence. But it acts as a good exercise to ask ourselves questions such as, are humans really ready to accept intelligent life elsewhere in the universe? But I'll give you a little bit of the background first, and then we can get into that question. So the general's name is Chaim Eshed. He served as the head of Israel's space security program for nearly 30 years. And he's a three-time recipient of the Israel Defense Prize. He has a doctorate in engineering, and he's been a professor. His specialty is satellite technology. He's 87 years old, and in a recent interview, he gave descriptions about exactly what sort of agreements have been made between the aliens and the United States and Israel, which ostensibly have been made because they wish to research and understand, quote, the fabric of the universe. Yep. So let me give you a couple of lines of quote directly from the general so you can hear it right from the source. They have asked us not to publish. These are the aliens. They have asked us not to publish that they are here. Humanity is not ready. Is not ready yet. Trump was on the verge of revealing, but the aliens in the Galactic Federation are saying, wait, let the people calm down first. They don't want to start mass hysteria. They want to first make us sane and understanding. They've been waiting for humanity to evolve and reach a stage where we will generally understand what space and spaceships are. There's an agreement between the U.S. government and the aliens. They signed a contract with us to do experiments here. They, too, are researching and trying to understand the whole fabric of the universe, and they want us as helpers. Now, here's the best, one of the best parts here. There's an underground base in the depths of Mars where their representatives are, and also are American astronauts.
Wait, there's an underground base on Mars?
Yes. Where there are representatives meeting from the Galactic Federation and the United States, are specifically U.S. astronauts.
But how did how did our people get there?
These claims that are so easily, like, fact-checked.
Yeah, this is the... These are the basic newsworthy claims that the general made. So let's take the appropriate amount of time to comment on the evidence that the general has presented in support of his claims. Okay, that's it. Moving on. Once again, what we have here is stories. These are fantastic stories brought forth by a person respected in his field, a three-time award-winning security analyst, honorable military service. It's a template. This has been happening since the days of Roswell, 1947, and it continues right up into 2020 and probably beyond. Look, there's no tangible evidence. There's nothing to see here. There's nothing to feel or look at or test. There's nothing to analyze. We can't correlate anything and we can't falsify anything. So the lack of evidence is really what the actual news story should be here. But reporters and media, if they were being honest, that they would be doing that and doing that public service. But frankly, they're not. But that's even another story. Now, you talk about the mother of all conspiracy theories. I mean, exactly how many humans in positions of government and private industries would have to keep this thing airtight?
Yeah.
I mean, does this not stretch plausibility beyond all limits?
I mean, the thing that this smacks of for someone like me is I've heard this exact story hundreds of times.
Yes, it's a template. We hear it regularly. This is what's a lot of skepticism is. We familiarize ourselves with exactly these things, and we know exactly we know what the arguments against those kinds of claims are, and they wind up never having the evidence to share. They all turn out to be stories. You know what I thought of with this. And I don't know exactly what the general is claiming concerning the technology. Kara, you alluded to how did they get there?
Right. This
Galactic – or Jay, I'm sorry. What this Galactic Federation has. Maybe they have some super-duper futuristic technology, but it's 100% undetectable by things like, the Mars surveyors and Mars orbiters and our Earth-based telescopes and our spectrometers and all the other devices that we have that which would detect something going on Mars were there some kind of, say, underground base and certainly human activity.
Yeah, NASA there. And the government are covering it up.
Well, apparently so. So that's part of the conspiracy. But also, what I thought of? I thought of Carl Sagan's story about the invisible dragon in his garage. What's the difference between an entirely undetectable background underground base on Mars and no base at all?
Right.
Which is the basic question. Yeah.
Well, it's all special.
There's
pleading.
No difference.
It's all there's no evidence, and then you just make up reasons why there's no evidence. But the world isn't ready argument is particularly lame. It's just ridiculous. Again, if they wanted us to know they were here, we'd all know. They wouldn't make contact with Donald Trump and not tell, with just, just certain governments and say, by the way, this is how I characterized it when I wrote about this. It's like, just wanted you to know that we're here, we exist, but you're not ready for this, so please don't tell anybody.
And also, if they told Donald Trump, we would have known in a tweet 30 seconds later.
I know. That's, sure. Right.
Hey, that's fair. That's very fair. Very fair.
No, so it's just silly. And the other thing is, it was silly 50 years ago, 60 years ago when they were saying that. But it was also coupled with the any day now, they're going to reveal themselves and it'll all come out. And now it's 60 years later and it's like any day now, but we're not quite ready yet. And just it'll happen. Just keep waiting. It's like the people who believe in the end times. Like we're in the end times. It's going to happen soon. We're the last generation, blah, blah, blah. They've been saying that for 2,000 years. Every generation thinks they're the last generation. Every newbie UFO enthusiast thinks that any day now the government's going to reveal the UFOs. But it's just all an elaborate excuse for the fact that there's zero evidence. And the simpler explanation, of course, is that there are no aliens buzzing the Earth or making contact with world leaders.
But my question is, bases on Mars.
Yeah.
My question is, why do these people continue to come up with the same exact narrative every 4 years, 5 years, whatever?
Yeah.
It just seems like
it works.
It's how it works. Yeah.
It's
also that's how narratives work. We hear things, we incorporate it into the way we make sense of the world, and then we just regurgitate it, weaving in different details. I like his reason for why did they make contact with us. It's because they need our help in order to understand the fabric of the universe. Why the hell do they need our help?
Right.
If they flew here
clearly
from another
they're doing
stellar
just
system.
Fine,
yeah.
Frankly.
It just doesn't even the story never holds together. Like you have to concoct this Frankenstein story that doesn't ever really internally make sense or hold together.
And they apparently signed contracts with us, which is, you know, it's so flimsy.
But it's like any conspiracy theory. Conspiracy theories in general work that way. You know, you have to keep grafting on these special pleading components to make it work. And then you get this, again, this massive contraption that falls in on itself.
But I like that it suggests the question, are we ready? And that is a fair question to ask, I think, and discuss and have an intelligent conversation about. I think that's legitimate.
But the answer is we don't know, because we won't know what happened till
it happens. Would we ever know? Think is the question, right? How could you possibly know and prepare for something that you have no idea how it would potentially unfold, reveal itself? Mm-hmm. You know, what can you really do? So is humanity ever really ready in that sense? I don't think so.
Well, we're bad at predicting how people are going to collectively respond to unique one-off events like that. You know what I mean?
But I will tell you that following human history, it would be incredibly, it would be like, oh my God. And then about 2 weeks later, like, people wouldn't care. You know what I mean? Like, it would, you know, unless they park a spaceship above one of our government buildings, like the movies love to do. You know, I mean, if we were contacted by aliens and they were benign and nothing crazy was going on, it would end up becoming normalized.
Mm-hmm. Could be. Like, we're adaptable. Yeah, I know. Like, in 3 years, we'll be like, hey, Frank, you know, the alien walking down the road. You know, it'd be nothing. No big deal.
Yeah. And of course, this is a theme that is consistently touched on in so many science fiction stories and television programs and movies, you know, Out of the Silent Planet, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Star Trek. One of my favorite movies, The World End, deals very directly with the very question, is Earth ready to join the galactic congregation of other intelligence out there? So, you know, all you have to do is be loosely associated with science fiction and you can come up with all sorts of stuff.
Okay, let's move on. Jay.
Yeah.
It's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, Steve and everybody else. Last week, I played this noisy. All right, I got some good guesses here. I got some funny answers as well. So the first person, Michael Conway, writes in and says, hey, Jay, just started listening to the podcast a few weeks ago. I think this week's noisy is a power hammer used by a blacksmith to forge steel. So I've seen those, and they kind of do
a little fast.
It is a little fast. That was going to be my feedback. They kind of sound like that too. It's more of a clang than a slap. But that was not a bad guess. But however, it is not correct. Let's move on. Kyle Pizzola wrote in and said, hello, I'm visualizing something from Looney Tunes, like a piece of rubber or leather on a rotating wheel slapping Elmer Fudd. My knee jerk to that was like, no, you're wrong. And then I re-listened to it. Listen. It's really, you know, it's not that bad.
Jay, didn't you say that you thought it sounded like Benny Hill slapping the old man on the head?
I did.
Well, that's not too far off from that.
I know. It totally has like that skin slapping sound. It really does. So anyway, Kyle, thanks, because you made me laugh and I needed to laugh. Incorrect, though. Next one, Patrick Carr and Visto Tutti both guessed that it was an electric spot welder. And I went online. I watched a couple of videos of spot welding. Spot welder, now there might be a couple of different ways that this is done, but the things that I Googled, I found where they take like these two, you know, copper looking electrodes that are kind of heavy duty looking, you know, it's like the size of a big knitting needle, and they touch the bottom, the top and the bottom of two pieces of metal, and it puts a current through them. It makes it, you know, the electrical current creates a ton of friction, and it heats up the metal so much it melts the metal. But it didn't have that slappy popping kind of sound. So, unless you guys have seen something different, you know, I just didn't find it that way. But anyway, the guess is wrong, but it might be an okay guess. I just couldn't verify if it was a good guess or not. Moving on to Gary Sturman. Gary said, hi, Jay. This was a tough one, but after much thought and a little imagination, I have decided this week's noisy is Bob Ross slapping his paintbrush on his easel.
Love Bob Ross.
So listen again.
Me too.
I mean, you know, it's okay. Funny. You made me laugh.
That's not a bad guess.
I know. It made me laugh a little bit because Bob Ross did do that. And then, of course, who's he face? What's his face? Made a joke. Remember that funny video that he was dressed up as Bob Ross? It was
like literally every
comedian. Wow. He's been, yeah. I mean,
no. But
dozens of parodies.
Remember when Deadpool dressed up as Bob Ross? Mm-hmm.
Oh, God.
Kind of. He did the same thing. It's funny. I laughed. All right. Anyway.
It's funny. Believe me.
You saw a stormtrooper dressed up as Bob Ross.
Yeah, that was a great mashup. I love that. We have a winner, though. Somebody finally won. I don't think we have a winner in a little while. Toby Shipman wrote in and said, my guess is that it's a tattoo laser removing machine.
Oh.
Wow.
All right. So
hear those hurt.
Listen again. This is a tattoo laser removing machine where it zaps the skin very quickly, like little circles, bah, 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 like that. And then you could see like the actual tattoo, like it you know, because the skin is getting blasted, right? So it maybe it's not changing as quickly as it looks because it's killing the skin on the outside. And it's heating it up. But here it is. Now, I'm pretty sure that noise is coming from the device that generates the laser, and that's not the noise of your skin being slapped by a laser.
No.
But I'm sure...
Your skin doesn't make a noise.
Yeah, there's no noise.
Because when you get laser hair removal, it doesn't sound like that at all.
I saw a guy... So this particular laser was from China. Somebody ordered it. It's super, super powerful. Like, it's overpowered. You know, it's like one of those things where you're like... You know, you could probably cook food with this freaking thing. So he tested it out, and he's like, you know... popping holes with this laser through different kinds of wood and metal and everything. And then he gets it on his hand, and it didn't really hurt him that much. Then he turned the power up, and then it did hurt him a little bit. It, you know, became painful, but it still didn't leave like permanent burn marks on the guy or whatever.
Right, but many lasers would, so don't play with lasers.
Yeah, don't even.
Like, just like I feel the need to interject.
Yeah, definitely. They're not,
and say, don't point a laser at your skin or your eyes especially.
Definitely not. Please be careful. Lasers could be fun, but they can also be absolutely dangerous. But, you know, I the whole thing of laser removal, you guys must have read about it by now. Like, it really does something interesting. You know that when they do this with the laser, that it's allowing your body to absorb the ink from the tattoo and you excrete it.
Yeah, but the hard thing about laser tattoo removal is that unfortunately the worse your tattoo, in many regards, the harder it is to remove, simply because a poorly done tattoo is laid at various depths into your skin.
Oh.
And so, so the laser has to reach because your tattoo's not in your top layer of skin, your epidermis, right? It's in your dermis, which is why tattoos look kind of weird when you see like autopsy photos and things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can see people's tattoos even when their top layer of skin has sloughed off. Mm. From what I've read, because I've had some tattoos that I'm like, do I keep it? Do I not? Is that it can be pretty brutal if your tattoo is laid poorly.
Yeah, I didn't know that, Kara. So like if it's not evenly done, if the tattoo artist wasn't good, then...
Yeah, if the depths are varied, that means the depths of the laser removal have to be varied, and that's much harder to do. So it's this like unfortunate irony that like the crappier tattoo, kind of the harder it is to take
And I'm
off.
Sure that it hurt
like,
more too,
dang it.
If you're getting it done by someone who doesn't really know what they're doing. Well, my canvas is clean. I have no needle has touched my body.
Really? Do any of you guys have tattoos?
No, I do not.
No, none of us do.
What?
Yeah.
That's amazing. I want you all to get tattoos at this age.
I would get it. Two circumstances where I would get a tattoo. If all of us got an SGU tattoo, I would do it. And if my wife wanted me to get a tattoo with her, like a co-tattoo, I would do it. But other than that, I'm not doing it.
Like half of a heart and she gets half
and
you line them up together.
Say, what if you joined the Navy and got drunk? Would you get it then?
Yeah, probably.
You'd get a lot of other things just
a
tattoo.
Yeah, you get a whole whole bag of weird shit. Yeah,
it's part of the package. You'd get the Navy.
Yeah, scurvy, the clap,
all sorts of stuff. The Bob Ross slap on the head, you know.
If I got something, it'd probably be like a computer circuit design or like a robot arm tattoo.
Yeah, I could see you doing that, Bob. And I can see Bob like lying in bed and he's like going, whew, 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 you know, like, okay, so let me move this on. So I have a noisy that was sent in by a listener named Nathan Erickson. And I'm not going to say anything about this. I'm just going to play it. I think that some people will instantly know and some people won't. And here it is. So my only clue is that Nathan recorded this one himself. And you can, if you have any ideas on what this is, if you have a cool noisy you heard. Now, there's got to be holiday-based noisies. There has got to be. So send them to me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steve, January 23rd, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. What do you want to do?
What's happening?
What do you feel like doing?
What's happening?
We are going to be doing a 12-hour patron thank you live stream. It'll be happening on January 23rd. It starts at 11 a.m. Eastern time and ends at 11 p.m. Eastern time. But we want you to join us because this is going to be a lot of fun. We have a ton of things already planned. We had a huge meeting yesterday. We went through the whole thing, soup to nuts. We have a couple of really cool projects that are going on. And one of them is something that the audience can join in on. And I'm going to give you a little teaser. We're going to be doing some cooking. We're going to be cooking, and you're going to ask that if you're interested, you could join us and cook along with us. Especially
virtually speaking.
Yeah, it'll be virtual. So what we'll do is we'll put it up on the website. We'll say, here are the recipes. Here's the ingredients. Here's everything that you're going to need. We're going to start doing this at X time. So if you're interested, you know, this is what you need to have prepped by this time. And then, you know, bring your phone or your iPad into the kitchen and we'll bounce back and forth. We're not going to have you watch us cook for an hour, but we're going to do something fun. And of course, the food that we cook will end up being the food that we eat during the major meal of the 12-hour show.
Yeah.
Hope it's good.
So, yeah, so it could be fun if enough people do it, it'll be fun to have a lot of people like eating the same thing along with us. But, you know, we're going to have a couple of different things. Like, I think everybody is going to bring something. Of course, Kara won't be with us. Because of COVID,
Yeah. We're
not 100% sure that Evan can be there because of COVID, but we're going to try. Like, we're all basically hyper in our own home-based bubbles. So I think everybody over here, it might be okay. It really, Steve's the only, the only, like, factor here because he has to go into the hospital every once in a while. But just so you know, we are going to be extraordinarily COVID safe. We're probably going to get tests if we are going to be in the same room together. Bob and I are in the same bubble, so Bob and I don't matter because we see each other all the time.
We matter.
But just trust us. We're going to be safe. So if you see us all in the studio with masks off, it's going to be after tests and incredible preparedness and being careful.
Evan is going to quarantine.
Hey, Steve.
Yeah.
Yes.
Steve might be vaccinated.
Could
by
be.
That. Not that you shouldn't still use social distance and mask after vaccination because you have no idea about the people around you. And you still have no idea where you're at. But still, you could be vaccinated by then.
So. Yeah, so that's going to be a lot of fun. January 23rd, 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern time. Yeah, we already have way, way more like planned that we probably need. We always over-prepare for these things. But it'll be good.
I have more thing. Wait, Steve. You know, I forgot something cool. We're going to ask our patrons to send in pictures of themselves. And because we have a couple of things on the back burner that we were talking about patron involvement, right? I don't want to underplay this. So we're going to ask that you're going to give a website and you're going to have a way to register and send your pictures to us and everything. But we're going to try to get some patrons involved, right? We don't not exactly how or who yet. We're still cooking up some ideas, but there will be patron involvement in this show.
Yeah, as much as we can, work in. At the very least, you should be able to play along with us for a lot of the things that we do. Okay, so one question this week, Bob. This is a number of people wrote in to follow up on the protein folding story that you talked about last week, and the feedback was essentially that maybe you overhyped the story a little bit too much.
Oh, what do you think overhyped about that?
Huh? Bob on a tech story.
Well, I'll push back on that a bit. Some people had the problem of saying that it's basically saying that the protein folding problem was solved. Now, I was very careful about that. I did not want to come out and say that this is solved because I know there's lots of caveats that wrap around that. But then I read quotes from people that were not part of DeepMind. For example, John Malt, who was essentially one of the co-founders of the CASP competition, he's the one that said, this is a big deal. In some sense, the problem is solved. This is a guy that runs CASP. He said this. Then there was Muhammad Al-Karashi, who was a CASP participant. He said that he suspects that people will leave the field as the core problem has been arguably solved. So these are people that are throwing the S word around regarding this. So I was careful. I made sure I quoted them. I mentioned them multiple times and then came back and said, yes, this isn't perfect. There's still work to do. But the core, it seems the core issue, the core problem is essentially solved, just kind of mimicking what these experts have said. So I think I covered my butt on my overexcitement, and I was excited, and I think this is going to be huge, but it's not slam bam solved right now.
When we talk about these stories, we're always striking a balance, you know, between being excited about legitimate progress, especially when it's significant. You know, it's not just an incremental advance, but it's like this is a pretty big advance. But then putting in the caveats about putting it into context and not getting overhyping it or getting premature or whatever. Most of the people who wrote back, you know, I think that they were saying things that we had said.
And we see that a lot, right? Just like,
yeah,
I know.
See
that a lot.
And it really just came down, and they also did, or they didn't mention anything specific. It was just like, you know,
the tone.
It comes down to tone. But which is important, though, not to downplay. You know, as science communicators, we want
right.
our audience to leave with a correct impression. I did feel that you were towards the hype end of the reasonable spectrum there. And I did pull you back, but I thought I pulled it back to an appropriate degree and provided balance. And that's a subjective thing, right? That's just subjective.
Right. But do you notice sometimes, Steve, that people will email and they'll be like, I can't believe you said X. And then it's like, did you listen to the whole thing? They're like, no, sorry.
That just happened like a half an hour ago. So, but it wasn't just that.
That's
it was
amazing.
Like, you know, so, and this gets to like how to email in general. When you're like cold emailing a podcast or whatever, we give a lot. You gave us feedback. This is our feedback to you. So we want you to email us. We love this part of the show. We love the conversation. The other thing is I read every email, and there's a really good chance I will not only respond to your email, but even engage you in conversation as mm-hmm. long as you're reasonable and you're not gratuitously a dick. You know, I probably will engage with you. But the, all we ask is that you are respectful of our time, and that involves a couple mm-hmm. of things. One, listen to the whole segment before you email us, and listen carefully. If you feel like you want to give us constructive feedback, that's fantastic. We're not trying to discourage that at all.
Absolutely.
But just be fair. Think, did they actually say this? What are they actually saying? Like, don't tell us to do things we already did, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, the other way to be respectful of our time is to just keep it, you know, reasonably short. Like, you know, we're not going to read a 5,000 word essay,
like,
you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, if they require me to scroll twice, like I don't have – we get
well,
so
but,
many emails
but a lot
a
of
day.
People do, which is a really good idea. They say, you know, here's the question or here's the executive summary.
Yeah,
and
do
then
the
if you want
TDLR.
More details – yeah,
right.
Exactly. Yeah.
If you want to go into all the details, here's all the details below. But here's like, if you just want to cut to the chase, here it is kind of thing. But with regard to the protein folding thing, it's like, yeah, you know, when you got down to the specifics, you know, we were giving the very specific details about how successful they were. I think also I was a little biased because I had already blogged about it. And I think like I was much more cautious in my blog. And that maybe was contaminating my impression of how we handled the topic because I was sort of mixing the two. But like I, you know, it was very clear to say, sometimes I can't remember what did I write and what did I say in the show. But like this isn't going to, we're not going to be reaping the benefits of this tomorrow. They have a lot of iteration to do before. And, you know, it takes 20, 30 years before like we start to see the benefits of this kind of basic breakthrough. I think the best feedback we got though was from, you know, people who were experts in the field and were giving us very specific details that I think went
right.
beyond what either we knew or what we got into to discuss. Like,
oh, I love that. Yes.
Yeah, that's great. We always love that, and that's one
so
of the
there's always to layers just, to that yeah. onion, right? You could always
yeah,
go
there's always
so
layers.
Deeper.
And, yeah,
and so
if it's your specialty, we want to know more
than you imagine.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and so specifically, they said like, you know, the. In order for this to actually be useful, for example, in medicine discovery, there needs to be a level of precision that we are not at. And even saying, like in the three-dimensional structure, it's not just getting it like 90% correct. It also has to be precise enough that you can base, you know, chemical discovery on it. And we're not there. And I agree. I mean, and again, this is like what I covered in my blog about. It's like, we're not there. It's like, this is going to take 10 or 20 years. Of iteration before probably, you know, that there are going to be actual applications coming out of it. I think what we were trying to emphasize is the potential, how important proteins are, how important understanding protein solving is. And when we get right. to the point where we have not just mostly solved it or you know, we've solved the core issues, but when we've solved it from a practical application point of view, there's massive benefits will flow from that. And it's actually even hard to overhype that, but we are not there yet. And so we do sometimes have to tweak our emphasis and make sure that we're balancing those two things correctly, which is why, and I think there was some appropriate feedback that we got on this issue, on this particular segment about that. But yeah, I think also some of it were sort of, they were glossing over the caveats that we actually did put in there, to be fair.
Yeah, okay. I don't think you would have let me gotten away with not having caveats, because there was caveats. Yeah. And I didn't like go into a deep dive on the caveats, but they were mentioned, and they're definitely there for sure. But this is a genuine reason to be excited, I think, this advance.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not incremental. It's not an incremental, you know, the usual incremental advance. This is much more dramatic.
But there's still a lot of work to be done. Still a lot of work to be done. Okay. I'm also going to do a follow-up to the name not logical fallacy from last week. We were talking about the slippery slope logical fallacy. And Kara and I both sort of thought of what I think is one of the most obvious examples of like the classic slippery slope argument, which involves gun regulation and the Second Amendment. You know, that the standard argument goes, if we allow the government to restrict gun ownership to any degree, that will go down the slippery slope to banning gun ownership completely, right? And that sort of has the classic form of the core slippery slope argument and commits all, you know, the core logical fallacy there, which is to say that if you take one incremental step, that you necessarily will lead to going all the way to the logical conclusion or the extreme conclusion of that, which is complete, you know, banning in this case.
Right, and you brought it up because it's an actual argument that we hear.
Yeah, it's a common argument.
It's like a real world example.
Yeah, and it's clearly a logical fallacy. Well, not surprisingly, some people pushed back on that in the in email, and I did have a fairly extensive exchange with one emailer. I'm not going to go into, you know, the name that person or anything, but just to you know, it did help me, I think, sort of wrap my head around. I always like to try to understand what is the fallacy that they're committing? Like, what is the error right. in thought that is leading this person to this, you know, to not understanding what I'm saying, for example. And in this case, I think this gave me some insight into like some of the logic here. So like they were saying that, well, if, you know, the Second Amendment says that the government will not abridge the, you know, the right to own a gun. And therefore any law that does abridge that right is a slippery slope because you've broken that cherry, if you will. You know, once you've broken the letter of the law, then there's nothing holding back, you know, going all the way. And that's incorrect, for a number of reasons. So the primarily is that it's an overly simplistic view of the law. Right. One of the arguments I made was don't fall for really simplistic legal reasoning and just appreciate the fact that legal reasoning is horrifically complicated. And unless you're an expert, you really just have to, you should be asking, what do the experts say? Not, right. I'm going to try to make my own argument about this, right? Because it's going to be hopelessly naive. I don't try to make my own arguments. I just say, what do the experts say? I try to get to some fundamental understanding of what is the actual discussion as much as possible. So like, for example, when it comes to the Second Amendment, there was actually two kind of issues here. The first one was, does the wording give people a collective right to own guns or an individual right to own guns? And initially this...
Right, and it actually never even says guns. It says arms.
It says arms. I know, arms. Yeah. That's the other thing. I'll get to that in a second. But because it says, you know, like a well-regulated militia being important to, you know, states defending themselves, the, you know, the right to bear and hold arms shall not be infringed. And for years, the Supreme Court ruling was that it was only a collective right, not an individual right. But then that was overturned not too long ago by the Miller decision, which said, no, it is an individual right to own and bear arms. But they, in the same exact decision, they said that, however, that's not incompatible. That interpretation is not incompatible with the government reasonably regulating gun ownership. So those two things sort of went together. So you just have to understand that the Supreme Court, the current interpretation by you know, the people that we put at the top of that, you know, legal pyramid of deciding how to apply the constitutional law decided that the Second Amendment does not preclude regulation. But the reason is there's so many other things woven in there. You can't just read the Second Amendment and think that you can interpret it. You have there's something called legal precedent, right? And legal precedent involves so many other lines of argument, like that, including interpreting other laws. Mm-hmm. So, for example, there is the question of, well, how do we define arms? How did the people who wrote the Second Amendment think of arms? Would mm-hmm. they have considered arms tactical nukes, right? Would they, for example, or, you know, miniguns that could shoot thousands of rounds a minute or something like that, or tanks, you know? So there is a reasonable question to ask about whether or not that's how that was conceived.
Right. But that comes down to a different, like that comes down to how one interprets the Constitution,
right.
Which is,
that's right.
is a scholarly conversation
exactly.
to be had that's separate from evidence. Like,
exactly.
It's, you know, just different people have different views about how literally the Constitution should be interpreted.
I'm talking purely in the realm of legal arguments and logic, not on what's mm-hmm. right or what the evidence says or anything like that.
Yeah.
This is just
yeah.
what's the legal reasoning here. The other legal reasoning, and this is taken from the Supreme Court decision, you know, where they said that, like, and this specifically had to do with a case of a state that banned the ownership of sawed-off shotguns. Right. And they said that there is no legal use of a sawed off shotgun that a law abiding citizen would have there. Right. That was their reasoning. There's no law abiding use that a law abiding citizen would have. Therefore, the right to own that gun is not protected by the Second Amendment.
Right.
And because that's just making the law work with all other laws, right? And with other legal reasoning, because the law should be internally consistent. And so, okay, so once you accept that, so now we're saying arms, you know, the right of an individual citizen to own an individual arm needs to be consistent with law-abiding activity. Well, there you go. There's your mm-hmm. argument for why. Well, then why does a law-abiding citizen need to have a fully automatic military style weapon, you know, and then that's where the
but some people disagree
with
the interpretation.
With that. You can disagree by that. This is the current decision of the Supreme Court of the United States. But the point is, getting back to the slippery slope argument, because mm-hmm. this is where the argument is being had, this does not mean that once you break the absolute right to own any arm, it's a slippery slope leading to banning all arms. Is not valid argument. It's not how it works, because there is other legal reasoning involved in where to draw lines. What the Supreme Court is saying is you can draw lines. Those lines could be based upon things like what are acceptable law-abiding uses of arms. And that is not a slippery slope by definition. That's why the slippery slope argument is fallacious, because it's not relevant to the actual legal reasoning that's going on. And again, I'm not saying that this is correct. I'm just saying that's the current Supreme Court precedent. That's the decision.
And I'm not saying it's incorrect when I'm saying what I'm saying. I just have a feeling we're going to get more emails after this than we did the first.
That's fine,
time.
And that's fine. But the thing is, this is not. I'm not really trying to create a venue about arguing about Second Amendment rights.
Exactly.
This is just, and I want you to just back up. Oh, the only point. So seriously, this is not about your feelings about gun ownership or the Second Amendment.
Yep.
This is about logic and legal reasoning. And all I'm saying, I'm making the extremely limited point that saying, you know, that there could be limits on gun ownership because of the Supreme Court's legal reasoning at a constitutional level, which is very complicated and nuanced. That does not validate a slippery slope argument about any gun regulations. If you think, you know, if you disagree with any particular gun regulation, you need to come up with a better argument than it's a slippery slope, because the slippery slope is a logical fallacy in this case. So this is purely about the logic. It's not about gun regulation. So don't, and I'm not even making a point. I'm not even taking a side. about gun regulation. I'm just saying this is the legal reasoning that's involved.
Well, and it almost speaks to Steve. Is there a logical fallacy that has to do? I mean, it's sort of like every cognitive bias has to do with motivated reasoning, mm-hmm. and has to do with some of these issues. But is there a particular logical fallacy that has to do with the fact that when something is more emotionally salient for you, it's harder for you to use logic?
That's not a logical fallacy. It's what you're saying is that's motivated reasoning.
It's motivated reasoning. Yeah. Because I think that is why these kinds of conversations obviously can become triggering. And it's funny because individuals who have an ideological or an emotional tie to it, it actually becomes harder to break down the logic. Yeah. It's sort of why in debate class, you're often tasked with debating the alternative viewpoint. Right. And you're like, morally, I don't know if I can do that.
No, it's great, though.
But it's really good practice.
Absolutely. And that's what I'm saying here. Step back from your emotional views about gun ownership and let's just talk about the logic involved. And that also helps you because, and again, we're seeing this in spades in American politics now where people are defending positions that they 100% would not defend if it was flipped to the other side. Right. I mean, they're like directly contradicting things that they have said in the past. And it's they're just making the arguments that are in favor of their side, not because they're logical or because they're consistent. But as good skeptics, we should always be able to back up from the implications of, and our political views and our tribalism and all that and just say, all right, if we just strip this down, what does the logic say? What's the logic here? All right, guys, let's move on to science or fiction.
Do it.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. All right, we've got three regular news items this week. No theme. You guys ready?
Yep.
All right, item number one. In the first instance of honeybees using a tool, they have been found to deliberately cover their nest entrance with animal feces in order to repel giant hornets. Item number two, in a new study of canine language ability, dogs demonstrated the ability to differentiate even words that differ by a single phoneme. So, for example, dig versus dog, right? And item number three, in a breakthrough study, a genetic therapy for an inherited mitochondrial eye disorder found that injecting the gene vector into one eye improved vision in both eyes. Evan, go first.
Honeybees using a tool deliberately covering their nest entrance with animal feces. That's brilliant. smart, smart honeybees. But is this really their first instance of using a tool? That's why I think this one might be the fiction. It may not be the first instance. That's what I'm thinking there. But I do think that they actually did use that tool. The next one about canine language. Dogs demonstrated the ability to differentiate even words that differ by a single phoneme. Anytime I think dogs come up in these science studies, we overestimate a little bit on what might really be going on here. So that's interesting, though. And the last one about genetic therapy for an inherited mitochondrial eye disorder. You inject the gene vector into one eye and it improves in both eyes. So does that mean the eye is just a channel to the brain and the actual improvement is happening in the brain and not the eye directly? I suppose that's what that would mean.
No, I mean, I'll tell you, it's happening in both eyes. As it says, it's in both eyes. It's not in the brain.
Improve vision in both eyes. Okay. So we're not talking about...
But it's in the eyes.
What the... Okay. All right. So it's actually happening. How did that... Why would it do that? I can't think of how that works because I am ignorant of such things. Boy, that one's really, really something. I'm leaning towards the dog one being fiction. I think of the three of these, I think they're all fiction, but the most fiction is the dog demonstrating. I don't think we can get it down to a phoneme in canine language. And again, I think studies about involving dogs and language and communication tend to yield more positive results than maybe what's actually going on. So I think that one's fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Okay, honeybees putting crap on their entrances. I mean, I do that in my house.
especially the past, to repel the giant hornets?
The past 8 months. Let's go jump to the third one. Yeah, the genetic therapy on the eye. That I immediately thought of something I read many years ago about if you like lifted weights with like one side of your body, like your right bicep, your left bicep, or left leg. You know, if you did your right leg, would see some benefit. So that kind of made me think of that. So and since I'll grab onto anything that makes sense, I'll say that that's maybe science. The one that's sticking out though is the dog one. Yeah, I think that's a little bit too subtle for them. I'll say that one's fiction.
Okay, Jay.
All right, so I'm taking them in order. I mean, there's a piece of information that I'm pretty sure about where bees like won't let another bee come in if they got drunk on a flower. Like this happens in Australia with the heat. You know, there could be like fermentation happening in the nectar, and then they won't let that bee in until they've kind of gotten rid of the alcohol.
Because it would contaminate the rest of the hive.
Absolutely, it would contaminate the honey, and they don't want boozy honey, because that honey is specifically made to feed the young. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
but this is not them putting it inside and contaminating. So I think bees are have had they're pretty smart in their own way. So I don't think this is that crazy. The second one about the canine language, I mean. Again, I have some information where I remember there was a show I watched where a guy was whistling to his pack of 15 dogs, and each one of them had a different whistle. So they were able to determine like the difference in notes. So I'm thinking that that is science, that they can hear the difference. So I'm going to just by default say that the third one, the one about the inheriting the mitochondrial eye disorder drug injection gene vector situation is the fiction.
And Kara?
I think I'm going to go with the other guys, not with Jay on this. Interestingly, the honeybee one, I have not heard this story, but there was a story literally this week about pandas rolling around in horse shit to keep warm. So maybe there's a poo theme in the news right now. It doesn't surprise me at all.
A lot of crap in the news.
Yeah, to use animal feces, I think, has long been kind of an evolutionary strategy. I think that the mitochondrial, this one's interesting to me. It's surprising, but I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility, simply because I think oftentimes when we talk about like gene vectors and gene therapies, we think about things that are happening in vitro. So you've got like a little petri dish and you've got some cells and you inject something into a cell and then the thing only happens to the cell. But I think we often forget that our bodies are like leaky. And they're fluidy, and there's like movement. And so I wouldn't be surprised if literally the injection, it was localized, but some of that genetic material, right, might have just moved. It might have been absorbed, through the eye into vessels, into interstitial fluid, and, your eyes aren't that far apart. I wouldn't be surprised if you could find traces of that genetic material literally somewhere else in your body as well. I just don't see how you can keep things super localized in the body. It's why drugs affect lots of off-target receptors. But yeah, an injection is usually more targeted. But the dog thing, I just don't believe it. I don't believe that a dog could differentiate a word by a single phoneme. I've long felt or believed, or even based on the evidence, that a lot of studies that come out about dogs' ability to discriminate language are really overblown. I think that, yes, they understand words. This is true and it's been demonstrated, but their vocabulary is insanely limited. And mostly dogs respond to emotion, to like staccato versus legato, loud, soft, all that stuff. Yes, they can recognize words, but I don't think that they can differentiate the word, walk from talk.
Okay.
Actually, that would be the same phone. Walk from
wick. Walk from wick.
Walk from walk.
Do they tell the difference between accents, though? Okay. Let's go.
Right.
Okay. You all agree with the first one. So we'll start there. In the first instance of honeybees using a tool, they have been found to deliberately cover their nest entrance with animal feces in order to repel giant hornets. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Cool.
Not surprisingly,
oh gosh, I thought you were gonna
is in Asian honeybees because they have to ward off those giant hornets.
Yeah.
Oh, those bastards.
Yeah. So that's they've evolved.
So they can bee ball.
They could bee ball. They could do swarming
and poop
kind
ball.
Of tactics. And now they also put poop in on their entrance because the hornets don't like it.
So, Steve, is this a new behavior?
It was a newly discovered behavior. Okay. You know, don't necessarily think that it's a newly evolved behavior, but it's newly mm-hmm. discovered. Yeah, pretty cool. And it is and they do describe it as the first known instance of, you know, honeybees essentially using a tool, you know, if you count the feces as a tool. So that's pretty cool. All right, we'll just take these in order. Number two, in a new study of canine language ability, dogs demonstrated the ability to differentiate even words that differ by a single phoneme. Jay, you think this one is science. Everyone else thinks this one is fiction. And this one is the fiction.
Damn it.
I thought I was going to get you on the puppy thing because you want to think that puppies could do this. But
puppies.
Dogs can absolutely understand words. They have a pretty good vocabulary. They can understand words
for a dog,
even separate from the intonation and the emotion and whatever. They can understand the actual mm-hmm. words. There's previous research showing that. So this is kind of following
up on
that.
Isn't it only like 60 words?
Yeah, something like that, 40, 50, 60, something. It's very limited for human perspective. That's a lot if you think about how many words your animal can understand.
For sure. But 60 words, I'm assuming if they could get 40, 50, 60, probably they're not 40, 50, or 60 that all sound really similar.
No. So what they found was that they could not distinguish words that only differed by one phoneme. So they need to be more different than that. That was kind of their – they have to have at least two differences. So they specifically said like they would not be able to tell the difference between dig and dog, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or sit and bit or whatever, or sit and sat.
Oh, so walk and talk, it was a good example.
Yeah, so but if there's two or more differences, then they have a chance, you know, of picking out the differences. So they're not as discriminating as humans are. So if you are teaching your dog, you know, you want to build the vocabulary, use different sounding words, you know, that which probably would happen mostly anyway, but I mean, it's good to know that specifically.
Especially if you're looking for commands that are like, you know, you want left versus right mm-hmm. or heel versus go. Like you want.
Yeah, the important things should be really distinct and you shouldn't have anything mm-hmm. that sounds like them that you're using as a command, right? Okay, all this means that in a breakthrough study, a genetic therapy for an inherited mitochondrial eye disorder found that injecting the gene vector into one eye improved vision in both eyes is science. Now, you might be asking, well, why would they do this? But this is essentially the way they designed this study. Where this is a particular genetic disorder called Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy. I've actually diagnosed patients with this. It's considered a neurological disorder. And it is a mitochondrial disorder. And you get bilateral optic neuritis, optic atrophy, and it's like one of the rare things that does that. And it usually presents in the 20s, you know, so late teens, early 20s sort of thing. So up till now, there really hasn't been any treatment. What the research was looking into genetic therapy using a viral vector. So they use a viral vector in order to insert a gene into the retinal cells that will then produce a protein that will go to the mitochondria and stabilize it so that you don't get the degeneration of the retina that leads to the loss of vision. And they were using patients who, because this is fairly rare, so it's like you can't have, you know, hundreds of people with it. So the trial was involved 37 people. So they used the patients as their own control, right? So in other words, they would inject the gene vector into one eye and they would do a saline placebo into the other eye. So they would.
Oh, hilarious.
So they were using the left eye.
The actual other
was
eye.
Was the control for the right eye, which kind of makes sense. And so they
didn't work out that well.
They were completely expecting, like, if this works, we'll know because the eye that got the gene will get better and the eye that got the saline will not get better. And what they found is that both eyes got better.
So what was the mechanism?
So technically,
yeah, I'm interested in this.
Well, we'll get to that. So technically, you might think, well, that means the study was negative because the two eyes were not different. The placebo was no different than the treatment. But the thing is, if you use the historical control of, you know, they should go blind, basically, and they shouldn't, you know, improve, any improvement is significant. And the eye that got the gene did improve more, significantly more than the eye that didn't get it, but both improved. And so the question was, well, why is that happening, right? So in order to
that makes me think there's a dose response thing going on.
There might be a dose response thing going on. So in order to test whether or not what was happening to the other eye, they did it in animals as a follow-up. And they did it in animals so that they could, you know, sacrifice them and find out, like, what's happening to the eye that's not getting the injection. And they found the gene, the therapeutic gene in the other eye. So it actually is getting there. It's not just some remote effect. The actual viral vector with the target gene was finding its way over to the other eye. So I think you're right, Kara. The body's leaky. You know, it's basically what's going on.
It'd be
on.
Cool to see how far from the target it ultimately ends up.
Yeah.
Or just a low level right. it find right, its way right. into like your ankle tissue.
So enough of it was getting over there that it was having a measurable benefit, you know, even though that wasn't the eye that was injected. But not as much as the eye that was injected. Yeah. Actually, not as much of a dose.
But how ironic that the actual control was the other
eye. No, it's not uncommon to do that. Use patients as their own controls, basically. You could do that with a crossover design, you know, depending on the study, where you, like, you're getting the treatment 1 week and then the placebo the other week. Or in this case, if you have two of something, like two eyes, you could use that as their own controls. So, but this is very exciting. The bigger news here is that, you know, that was kind of just a quirky anomaly. But the big news here, there's a gene therapy for this optic atrophy, which is working, which has had like 70% improvement in vision, which is huge. The magnitude of the effect was actually was significant. So this is, you know, we're finally like really getting to this age of gene therapy, you know. Again, we sort of had a false start in the 1990s and then we ran into trouble and now we're sort of rebooting, you know, the sort of viral vector gene therapy sort of approach. And we're starting to see some real positive clinical trials, you know, so it's great. Glad to see it.
And also it speaks to, we got an email question just this week about kind of like, how would CRISPR work in people? How do you actually, and CRISPR is a whole other thing, you know, the way that they get to that gene therapy is different. But the question seemed to be more about the mechanism of delivery. Like, how do you get a gene therapy into a human being? Does it have to be in the embryo? Does it have to be? And obviously, depending on what you're trying to do, the answer to that is different. But this is one example of a situation in which in an already developed person who has, you know, the defective gene, they're able to see a change, which is really cool, now, just by injecting.
Yeah, but I didn't see any mention that this used CRISPR in any way, but this...
No. Yeah, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah, you're right.
How you got to the therapy.
This is a viral
matter.
Vector, which is very common. So some, you know, viruses, one of the things that some viruses do is insert their genetic material into cells. And so you have to find a benign virus that's not going to cause an infection, that's going to go to assert the cell population that you're targeting, that will inject the, you know, the gene that you're interested in. And that's sort of, that's a very complicated technology that's taken us 30 years to develop, right? Or more. But it works. You know, so it's all about the virus, right? It's all about the properties of the virus itself as the vector.
Yeah, so any sort of vector or any sort of, like, there's all these different really interesting ways to get the treatment into the genetic material. And it's really cool to hear about like such a, it's almost like such a simple mechanism in these individuals. Literally just inject it right to where it needs to go. But hey, keep in mind, it's floating around in other spots too.
Yeah, totally. All right. Well, good job, guys.
Well, not really, but.
Thanks.
Except for Jay. All right, Evan.
No, thank you, Evan and Bob.
Evan, give us a quote.
That which parents should take care of here is to distinguish between the wants of fancy and those of nature. That was written some time ago by John Locke, the famous English philosopher. And he's known probably more for his treatises on, say, government and perhaps religion. But he also wrote I guess what we would call a book today, but back then it was a paper, Some Thoughts Concerning Education. This was in 1693. And my best understanding of this is that he's saying that parents should be guiding their children towards learning about the natural world, about science, and about things that are real, as opposed to the wants of fancy and fantasy.
Yeah, and I interpreted that more as just reality, you know, like those of nature, you know, the wants of nature to be just reality, not necessarily science, but, you know, just... Like, there's the things, the fantasies that you want to be true, and then there's reality that actually is true, and you need to learn how to distinguish those two things, right? There are some world leaders who need to learn how to distinguish
those two things. Absolutely. No doubt about it.
Yeah. I think the general notion that adults are just children who hide their irrationality better is largely true. You know, that obviously it's not completely true. People actually can control themselves better. And as they get older, they get more neurologically sophisticated. But to a huge extent, I think a bigger extent that we want to admit, we are children with a social filter, you know?
So, and some are more.
And some people have more of a filter than others.
But, yeah. Says the girl who's entered the dating world again.
Oh, boy.
That's a distant memory for me, man.
I know.
Happily married.
Don't be jealous, you guys. Yeah. It's awesome, especially during a pandemic.
Yeah, sure.
I can only imagine.
All right. So we will be doing a live stream over the next few weeks. Probably not the Friday after Christmas. Is Christmas a Friday?
What was Christmas?
It is. Of course.
Yeah. Not Kara. Exactly.
Not exactly. Christmas. We won't be doing a Friday live stream on Christmas, but we will be doing it on the two Fridays before Christmas. And then
New Year's Day is on a Friday.
New Year's Day.
New Year's Day.
Friday.
It's weird that that's the holiday because that's just when people are hungover.
What do you think? Are we going to do it on New Year's Day? Probably not.
I'll be home.
Maybe. Maybe we'll do it without you, Steve. I haven't shown up to one in like months.
So we'll be doing the Friday live stream. We'll do it this week, obviously, but it's the day before this comes out. But we'll be doing it on the 18th. We won't be doing it on December 25th. We may or may not do it on January 1st. We'll see. Probably, because that's, you know, what else are we going to do? And then back to our usual schedule. We probably won't be doing it on the 22nd because it's the day before the 12-hour show.
Mm-hmm.
But
makes sense.
But otherwise, we'll be doing it. We actually,
I cannot contain my excitement.
Yeah, we've began discussions about rebooting the Extravaganza, our live stage show, like maybe for next fall.
Yeah,
6 months they were saying. 6 months. So midsummer maybe.
Maybe 9 months.
Dream.
Yeah, it's hard to say. Hard to say. But until next week. This is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.